As commented on by Dr. Armstrong, there is a strong clinical research evidence base supporting the use of intraperitoneal chemotherapy in ovarian cancer, and it's logical that investigators would wish to evaluate this modality plus bevacizumab. I met with Dr. David Spriggs, who was part of a research team who presented preliminary safety data on this strategy at the last ASCO meeting. Dr. Spriggs began by reviewing the rationale for this work.
The point of the study that we presented at ASCO and Dr. Jason Connor was the principal investigator and the presenter of this particular study. We were interested in identifying ways to enhance intraperitoneal therapy. Memorial Hospital has been committed to the delivery of intraperitoneal chemotherapy for almost 20 years. And the evolution of the field has been quite extraordinary in that over the past 10 to 12 years, there have been three consecutive phase 3 studies, all of which demonstrate that there is a substantial advantage in terms of overall survival for patients receiving intraperitoneal chemotherapy for ovary cancer. And that's a reflection of the fact that ovarian cancer is primarily a disease of the peritoneal cavity. The peritoneal cavity is lined by a specific kind of mesothelium that, among other things, expresses a protein called mesothelin. And mesothelin is a documented target and presumed ligand for the CA125 molecule, which is also called MUC16. And so what we believe is that the ovarian cancer behavior is really a reflection of the fact that so many of the ovarian cancers express CA125 and MUC16, and as a consequence have a propensity to bind to tissues which express mesothelin. So logically, what you find is that there is a very logical predominance of ovarian cancer in the peritoneal cavity. And so delivering cancer chemotherapy agents to the peritoneal cavity then becomes a much more rational approach. So in this study, we were interested in trying to add to the peritoneal chemotherapy a new drug, bevacizumab or Avastin, which is a very active drug in ovarian cancer. And over the past two or three ASCOs, there have been a series of reports suggesting that as a single agent, Avastin is quite potent in terms of inhibiting the growth of ovarian cancer and even shrinking ovarian cancer as a single agent.
I really like that way you were explaining the biology there in terms of the peritoneum. So maybe you could take a crack at Bev and why you think it works in ovarian cancer, and do you think it's different maybe than, say, what happens with, say, colon, lung, or breast cancer?
Bevacizumab is an interesting drug in that what it does is it binds to a natural occurring growth factor, vascular endothelial growth factor, or VEGF. And VEGF has been shown in many different cancers to be associated with a bad outcome in the cancer because it seems to promote the growth of new blood vessels and allow the cancer to grow more readily in normal tissue. Ovarian cancer is unique in that the VEGF seems to be a highly potent molecule in terms of promoting the growth of ovarian cancer. If one looks at kidney cancer, breast cancer, colon cancer, while bevacizumab has been associated with an improvement in all of those cancers, as a single agent, bevacizumab is really not very effective. In contrast, for ovarian cancer, bevacizumab has about a 15 to 20% response rate administered once every 2 or 3 weeks to a patient with advanced ovary cancer, even patients who have experienced a lot of prior chemotherapy. So this represents a unique opportunity to really change the biology of ovarian cancer by administering the bevacizumab either alone or, in this case, in combination with the best available standard therapy, which we believe to be a combination of Taxol or paclitaxel and cisplatin or carboplatin in the context of early ovarian cancer treatment.
It looks like in Memorial, there is work being done that you're involved with in the lab looking at the issue of the in vitro and in vivo effects of Bev and also in cetuximab, which is getting more and more interesting in general. Can you talk about what you've looked at and what you've seen?
Yes, we've looked at two different antibodies, both bevacizumab, which is an antibody against the ligand VEGF, and cetuximab, which is an antibody against the receptor for the epidermal growth factor, or EGF, and tried to ask how these different drugs were having their effect on ovarian cancer cell lines. And my colleague, Siobhan Kehoe, went through a fairly sophisticated and laborious analysis looking at direct cytotoxicity of the two antibodies, the ability of the two antibodies to mediate cell death through lymphocytes, which through their activation can generate killing molecules that will lyse the cancer cells, or alternatively through stromal interactions with the vasculature and the connective tissue in the host. And so all three of those mechanisms have been reported to be active in certain kinds of monoclonal antibodies. And what we found was that Siobhan demonstrated that the VEGF appeared to interact predominantly with circulating VEGF produced by the tumor cells and had no direct effect on the cancer cells themselves, nor did the bevacizumab have any real synergy with lymphocytes in terms of killing the tumor cells in an assay that combined tumor cells, the antibody, and normal human lymphocytes. And that really was in a sharp contrast to her work with cetuximab, which targeted the receptor for the EGF ligand. In that case, the epidermal growth factor receptor was a marker for the ability of the antibody cetuximab to interact with the surface of the cancer cell and in the presence of normal human lymphocytes to represent a pathway by which the lymphocytes could directly kill the cancer cell.
In a number of different arenas, again, some of the investigators in other tumors, been a lot of discussion and controversy about exactly what the mechanism of anti-tumor action of Bev actually is. And is it truly anti-angiogenic, or is that the main mechanism? And there's also been discussion about normalization of blood supply and better delivery of systemic agents to the tumor. Any thoughts about this overall issue and then ovarian cancer specifically, particularly in light of, as you say, this single agent response rate, which you don't really see in a lot of these other tumors?
I think bevacizumab is a very interesting molecule because it can act in so many different ways. And the combination treatments and the single agent treatments can result in very different outcomes. If one combines bevacizumab with chemotherapy, there are several ways that the interaction might be favorable in terms of controlling tumors. One is it might normalize the tumor vasculature and allow the chemotherapy agents better penetration into a larger tumor where the interstitial pressure can be increased by the leaky capillaries associated with cancer. And the bevacizumab decreases that leakiness, and as a consequence, the interstitial pressure drops, and therefore the diffusion of a drug like paclitaxel or platinum into the tumor can be more effective. A second way that bevacizumab can work is that bevacizumab can just starve the tumor directly, and if bevacizumab results in a loss of these vessels, which would be providing blood, nutrients, oxygen to the tumor, the tumor stops growing and can actually involute. And then the third possible mechanism is one where the VEGF ligand, which is sequestered by the bevacizumab, provides the tumor cells directly with a survival signal. And when that survival signal is removed because the ligand can no longer interact with the receptor on the cell surface of the ovarian cancer cell, you have the consequence of the loss of that survival signal, which may be related to a direct cellular death, or it might be related to a circumstance where the cell becomes more sensitive to chemotherapy because one of the signals for survival has been lost. So either of those can occur. And so bevacizumab, in the context of ovarian cancer, seems to have either a direct vascular effect starving the tumor and causing tumor shrinkage, or perhaps a loss of that survival signal. But the consequences in either case is that a certain percentage of the ovarian cancer patients treated with bevacizumab will actually see a measurable regression in the size of their tumors.
Another thing I think I've heard in some of our recent ovarian interviews is a question about sort of an anti-ascites effect, maybe directly, that in some way maybe more vascular or something rather than directly against the tumor. I know it would be kind of hard to actually tell that, but I've heard about occasional cases of people with very progressive ascites that seem to do very well on Bev, but maybe the objective tumor markers, et cetera, aren't really changing. Question mark, is it something else going on? Any thoughts about that?
Yeah, I think that it's almost certainly true that bevacizumab and drugs like bevacizumab will reduce ascites. And in order to see that, you have to think about the pathophysiology of ascites. Ascites is an ultrafiltrate of plasma, and it is the consequence of having plasma seep through the loose intraendothelial connections in tumor vessels and accumulate in spaces where the pressure is lower, like the peritoneal cavity. And so if one gives a drug like bevacizumab, reduces the circulating VEGF, you can then tighten up those connections between the endothelial cells, decrease the amount of ascites leaking out of those tumor vessels, and as a consequence have the balance between ascites formation and ascites reabsorption begin to favor reabsorption, and the ascites can dry up. And that's really completely independent of any direct effect on the tumor cells themselves. The only problem with it is that it is a very, very difficult thing to use as an endpoint in a clinical trial because there are many things that cause ascites, and measuring ascites is very complicated. And so it's almost inconceivable to imagine a way that you could use the resolution of ascites as a approvable endpoint in a clinical trial. But there's no doubt that it does have a really important effect for the patients in terms of quality of life.
So I take it then you've observed that yourself in your own
practice? Oh, absolutely. One sees that very commonly. I have a group of patients who have been receiving bevacizumab continuously since June of 2005, when the first reports of bevacizumab activity in ovarian cancer were reported in that meeting. And some of those patients were very advanced at the time they began on the bevacizumab and have really had just a remarkable improvement in the quality of their life. Their CA-125 has gone from the thousands down to the hundreds and the tens and has been able to be maintained there. Now, sadly, not every patient that receives bevacizumab has that kind of a response. But when a patient does have a good effect from bevacizumab, it can be very durable and result in a huge improvement in quality of life.
Not to get too far out on a tangent, although this seems to lend itself to that, what about Bev in ascites, you know, with tumor cells in the fluid in other tumors, and what about mesothelioma?
Well, certainly the mechanism that would decrease ascites in the context of ovarian cancer would be equally at play in most other tumors, because the pathophysiology is the same, that there's a leaky vasculature which is in part resolved by the removal of the VEGF from the circulation. as far as its potential in mesothelioma, because mesothelioma does represent a little more, it's not a classic epithelial cancer, it's a little harder to know exactly what the consequences are going to be. It would certainly be conceivable that the consequences will be favorable in mesothelioma as well, but I don't know that we're at a point where we can say that confidently.
Let's get back to the study we were discussing.
I'd like to talk just a little bit about the rationale of the study, because at the time the study was designed, there were two simultaneous things going on. One, that there was an increasing acceptance of the fact that intraperitoneal therapy had become the best alternative for primary treatment of ovary cancer. Simultaneously, there was this breaking news about bevacizumab, and there were no clinical trials that really allowed us to combine the two into a single treatment for patients. And so in order to find out whether or not combining the two is possible and tolerable, it's important to go into a phase 1-2 study to look at the toxicity rates, make sure that there's no adverse interaction between the drugs, and things continue to turn out at least as good, if not better. And the goal of our study and other studies that are being done under the GOG's umbrella, the GOG is the Gynecologic Oncology Group, which represents the leading centers for gynecologic oncology care across the United States and even into sites in Europe and Asia and Australia. But there was no established way to combine these agents, and so the idea was to do a series of pilot studies to try to see how best to combine the drugs together so that the next study that can be done by the GOG in a large randomized fashion is to really make sure that this combination can be tested safely and really we can move on to a new standard of care, which would probably, we hope, will include bevacizumab as well as platinum and Taxol. So that was the rationale of the study that we set up.
Just to enlarge a little bit on that background, can you talk about what was known at that point and now what is known now in terms of the side effects and toxicity of bevacizumab and whether there are any particular concerns about using that agent in the face of intraperitoneal therapy?
Well, I think that bevacizumab is a remarkably well-tolerated drug. It has some logical consequences that, again, understanding the physiology of the kidney and how VEGF works, it's not surprising that over time there's a certain amount of proteinuria that shows up in the urine, that there are bleeding and clotting problems, which can occur, although the frequency is low. And hypertension is a fairly common side effect. Now, none of those side effects are deal breakers in the context of a single agent. The difficulty comes in that in first-line treatment of ovary cancer, all of these patients have had an aggressive surgical procedure. So putting bevacizumab into the patient who has recently had surgery is a high-risk circumstance, and one has to be very careful to make sure that you're not promoting the formation of new blood clots, heart attacks, strokes, some of the things that would be associated with bevacizumab. There's also a separate issue in that bevacizumab would interfere with new blood vessel formation during wound healing. And in a patient who has just had an 18-inch incision in order to do a maximal tumor debulking, interfering with wound healing is not a trivial issue either. So for a number of reasons, it was important to do this. Finally, the other issue that was in the background is in 2006, there was a report to suggest that perforation of the small bowel was a not uncommon side effect of bevacizumab in patients with ovarian cancer. And that really gave us a serious concern as we began to think about combining things together. Patients frequently will have bowel surgery and anastomoses of small bowel or even large bowel before they would go on to primary therapy. And having those patients receive bevacizumab early on in their course might conceivably lead us to bad outcomes.
Now, the sort of rule of thumb that seems to be evolving in other tumors, particularly colon cancer, is a sort of 6-week window between surgery and bevacizumab. Does that work for ovarian also?
We didn't test that question. In our study, we decided that we would take that as a given because that seemed to be the most prudent thing to do. And so what we did was we said that our patients would not receive bevacizumab with their first cycle of chemotherapy, which is routinely administered 3 or 4 weeks after surgery. So the time before our patients saw bevacizumab for the first time was 6 to 8 weeks. And we felt that was a safe interval based on the larger colorectal experience. And we have found that that's generally been the case.
Now, in the face of that, there's also, as you mentioned, the issue of bowel perforation. Again, we've heard this in different tumors, particularly colon cancer. And I'm curious about what your take is on this. I don't know whether right now, for example, you're using bevacizumab in sort of an off-label, off-protocol situation. And if you are, what do you say to patients about that risk? And how do you individualize it to the patient and the type of surgery, et cetera?
Yeah, well, I think that's a really important question. I think the bowel perforation has been not common, but has been observed in colon cancer and ovarian cancer. What's interesting is the same drug does not seem to cause bowel perforation in lung cancer or breast cancer. And so what that says to me is it says to me that you have to have some kind of an abnormal process going on in the peritoneal cavity on the surface of the bowel in order to put the patient at risk. So having said that, I am more concerned about patients with bulky tumor on the surface of their small intestine or large intestine. But we have been unable so far to really ascertain what the true risk factors are. And so I think that in a situation where you might offer such treatment to a patient in an off-label setting, one has to be very clear and explain to the patient and her family that the incidence of bowel perforation is not completely established, that it may be as low as 1%, it may be as high as 8 or 9%, depending on the study that you look at, and it's almost certainly somewhere in between. There are a couple of interesting things about the bowel perforation. One is if one looks back at the canister study from 2006, although there were a number of bowel perforations, I normally think of an intestinal perforation in a cancer patient as being a fatal event, and yet most of those patients were able to survive, some even with conservative therapy. So that I think that the amount of bowel contents that escape following a perforation may be different depending on the circumstance, and that's one thing to think of. But certainly the patient must be prepared for the risk of that, just as the patient needs to be prepared for the risk of blood clots, stroke, heart attack. And although these are uncommon events, you know, they're profound. And the consequences for a sick patient who has one of these other events can be very serious. And so patients need to know this. And I think outside of a clinical trial, one needs to be careful that you're thinking about this as a relatively later intervention, so that you're not running the risk of shortening people's lives.
You know, I guess the way you described the bowel perforation reminded me a little bit about how some of the colon cancer studies described a similar thing, that they had bowel perforations, but it wasn't a catastrophic event. And I think also on our colon series, Mike O'Connell from the NSABP told us that at this coming ASCO meeting, they're reporting the safety data from the NSABP adjuvant colon study, C08, and they're not going to report an increased incidence of bowel perforation. Of course, NED, there's no tumor, mm-hmm. which sort of supports what you're saying.
Yeah. My colleague Bill Tu has gone back and looked at our experience with bowel perforations in the pre-bevacizumab era with ovary cancer. And it's not as common as you might think. It's relatively rare. Everything happens, but it doesn't happen commonly. And so I don't think there's much doubt that there's some increase in risk for a patient with existing tumor on the surface of bowel, but I think it's probably below the 5% level and is probably acceptable given the great potential for bevacizumab for carefully selected patients who don't have underlying hypertension, who don't have a predisposing clotting disorder, who've not had a bleeding diathesis, who don't have brain metastases. I think there are a lot of patients who ought not to receive bevacizumab, but I think for selected patients, it can be profoundly helpful.
What are the situations, if any, where you're going to present to patients the option of bevacizumab in a non-off-label, non-protocol manner?
The opportunity to receive bevacizumab, really, I don't do it off-label for first-line treatment. I don't do it off-label for second-line platinum-sensitive retreatment. And generally, I would say that patients should have received liposomal doxorubicin because that has been shown to be associated with a superior survival compared to gemcitabine or topotecan in some settings. Having said that, I think that patients who have received perhaps Doxil and gemcitabine as single agents for platinum-resistant disease, I think that bevacizumab has a single-agent effectiveness of 15 to 20%, which is completely comparable with what you would expect with topotecan, gemcitabine, and nalbuphine, among others. And so I think you can look at this and say it is a reasonable choice. It has relatively few side effects on a chronic basis, but does have some rare but very serious side effects. And patients need to explore those risks and benefits with their physician carefully and then make a decision that's really based on their priorities. And it's a difficult discussion because the toxicities are so severe when they occur, but on the other hand, relatively few patients experience them. And so it needs to be a careful discussion. And then there is one other issue, and that is the financial issue, which is not a trivial issue because not all insurance companies are willing to pay for off-label bevacizumab usage, even in a situation like ovarian cancer where there are some very good studies suggesting it's beneficial. The cost is very high, and you know, I certainly do not encourage patients to borrow money or mortgage their house or do that for the potential benefit of bevacizumab because at this point, I don't think that the data is so strongly supportive that I can really recommend that.
And again, just to explore the clinical context in which this sort of trial sits, the other obvious aspect is the intraperitoneal therapy. And I'm curious, at Memorial, in your own practice, for example, where IP therapy fits in outside of a protocol setting and what you think's going on across this country, both in tertiary centers and the community in terms of its use.
Well, I have the good fortune to practice at Memorial Hospital. And what that means is I have the access to really highly qualified surgeons who know how to place catheters. We have a low complication rate below 3%. I practice with some extraordinary nurses who have a lot of experience administering IP chemotherapy. And the administration of IP chemotherapy tends to be more of a nursing problem than a physician problem, in all truth. You know, the physician writes the order and deals with some of the side effects, but the delivery of intraperitoneal therapy requires genuine nursing skill. And I think that if one looked across the country and said, why are people not doing this? I think there are two main reasons. And one of the main reasons is that cisplatin is a more toxic drug than carboplatin. And we don't really have good data to say that carboplatin is a good drug for intraperitoneal administration. And that's the first reason. And the second reason is that when you do intraperitoneal therapy, it takes more time in the chemotherapy suite. The patients really need to be able to lie down. And it takes a lot of nursing time and a lot of nursing skill. And not all places, particularly outside of major centers, really have the wherewithal to provide that kind of support. So I think those are both genuine barriers. I think that we all got spoiled with the carboplatin because carboplatin is much easier to give than cisplatin. Those of us who are a little older remember when cisplatin was the only choice and we learned how to give cisplatin relatively safely with the modern antiemetics, aprepitant, and the 5-HT3 blockers. The nausea can be well controlled, but it takes more effort on everybody's part. And I think that to me, if I look at the three studies, there's no doubt that it's worth it for a patient trying to get curative treatment. And so we both on protocol. Dr. Connor's protocol is the one that we're currently doing for upfront optimally debulk patients with ovarian cancer using the bevacizumab and the IP cisplatin, but also for my patients off clinical trial who perhaps might not be eligible for bevacizumab for some contraindication, I still would very much like to have them get the benefit of intraperitoneal treatment, and I do treat patients off protocol with intraperitoneal chemotherapy.
What are the situations where you might think twice about doing that, and particularly, I guess, if you think about an older patient or one with comorbidities?
Yeah, I think that one has to look at the patient, and I think the complications of IP cisplatin tend to be neuropathy. There's more nausea associated with that kind of a program. The patient is more likely to need hydration, to waste magnesium and potassium. And so patients with cardiac disease where hypomagnesemia and hypokalemia might be dangerous would be a population I wouldn't want to treat with intraperitoneal cisplatin. I'd like to avoid treating patients with a pre-existing neuropathy from diabetes or some other underlying problem. Someone with a significant hearing loss at baseline would be someone else who cisplatin would not be a good choice.
You know, from an ethical perspective, looking at a doc in practice who doesn't have that type of support that you do and doesn't therefore, let's say, use IP therapy, do you think that there's sort of an ethical obligation to say to the patient, listen, this is out there, I don't do it. If you want to consider it, I can send you somewhere else?
I think so. I think that if one looks at the most recent data, the GOG 172, where the survival advantage is measured, you know, in the neighborhood of 10 months, I think you've really got to say to a patient, this is a potentially better therapy. It is difficult to give. It is somewhat more toxic. It takes more resources than I can muster in my own small practice. But if you want to do this, understanding that there are pros and cons to it, I will help you find a provider who does this well.
You know, our CME group is always doing patterns of care studies. We've done many in breast cancer, colon, lung. We just, you know, prostate. We just sort of ask people what they do. And I would love to do one in ovarian cancer. And I guess I wonder if you have any thoughts about what really is happening out there in practice. Are people presenting the alternative of going somewhere else? How many people are using IP therapy in the community? Any thoughts or ideas?
Well, it's an interesting sociology experiment. And when the first intraperitoneal chemotherapy program was reported by Dave Alberts in the Journal of Clinical Oncology in the very early 1990s, it came almost simultaneously with the introduction of paclitaxel. And although paclitaxel in 1993 was not an easy drug to give, it was a new drug which was perhaps easier to deal with than a new technique. And so paclitaxel, with the marketing muscle of Bristol-Myers Squibb behind it, really overcame the idea of intraperitoneal treatment because it was something you could do without changing your pattern of care too much. It gave your patient genuine benefit, and there was no data to say that you could do both paclitaxel and intraperitoneal treatment simultaneously, and it took us, you know, a half a dozen years to develop that data. The same thing happens now in that I think people see bevacizumab as being the same kind of paradigm-shifting drug introduction, and the current clinical trial within the gynecologic oncology group is a carboplatin paclitaxel plus bevacizumab randomized trial. I think if you're a practicing physician, you can look at this and you can say, this is an acceptable alternative to doing intraperitoneal therapy. And it's been reviewed all the way through the National Cancer Institute, and the national IRBs have said this is an ethical thing to do, even in patients who are potentially eligible for IP therapy, if you're discussing it with them. And so I think that people can look at this and say, I'm still doing what could be considered cutting-edge therapy without having to disrupt everything that I do in order to do IP therapy.
That's interesting. And I guess the other alternative would be what you looked at in this study, which would be to combine IP therapy and bevacizumab. But just getting back to this question of just using Bev, again, off-label, off-protocol, are you saying that you think that that's a rational alternative for patients?
Well, the GOG study 218 of carbotaxol plus or minus bevacizumab, I think, is a very important study. And it's about a half to two-thirds accrued. So we're going to know the right answer to this. But I think that it's worth noting that in some other diseases, for example, breast cancer, we're not moving the survival by adding bevacizumab in some contexts in breast cancer.
Well, that's in metastatic disease.
In metastatic disease. Now, will we move the survival numbers by adding Bev in ovary cancer? You know, we all hope so. But I think it is fair to say that we don't know that. And so to just do it off protocol, I think, is something that I would not recommend because of the risks of bevacizumab. And so what we hope to get out of GOG 218 is not only does it work, but how long to give it, because there are patients who get it only during therapy and then people who get it for an extended period of time after therapy. And that will hopefully tell us whether or not it's really just in combination with chemotherapy or for a more sustained period.
And I have to say that I'm hearing the same exact response in colon, lung, and breast. And I think about your colleagues down the hall there at Memorial too. And I think most people are not using Bev in the adjuvant solid tumor setting until we see data, but it's going to be pretty soon, at least in colon cancer. I think the latest it's going to be is September 09. So we're going to know at least about one tumor pretty soon.
But of course, the assumption that it's going to make a difference is the tricky part of that, because it may not. I think that exactly what the biology is that drives a recurrent cancer and whether or not that biology is going to be substantially altered by a static agent like bevacizumab is at this point an unknown.
Yeah, I've always liked to ask people to try to predict what trials are going to show in the future. And usually they'll take a shot at it, but people do not want to predict about adjuvant Bev because I think people just have no clue.
Yeah. I think that if I had to place a bet, I would say that Bev in an adjuvant setting in ovary cancer will probably extend survival, but probably not as much as people would like it to be. I don't think it will be the 10 months that we're seeing out of the IP therapy or the 9 months that we saw out of paclitaxel.
So let's talk a little bit about what you actually presented in terms of the trial. Could you first review the exact treatment platform and then what you saw?
Yeah, the treatment platform was a modification that my colleague Carol Agajanian put together that I think was really a step forward in that as oncologists who've treated patients with 100 per meter squared of cisplatin and 75 milligrams of cisplatin understand very well, there's a huge difference in terms of the toxicity profile. And so we believed that based on data looking at IV cisplatin, that 50 was as good as 100, and in all of the meta-analyses, there's really very little evidence to suggest that there's a significant dose response to cisplatin. And so we felt that by decreasing to 75 of cis, we could ensure that roughly two-thirds or 50 milligrams per meter squared of cisplatin was getting into the circulation, and that had been shown in a large study by Bill McGuire to be equivalent to 100 per meter squared. So we were really comfortable with the 75 per meter squared of cisplatin. But we were trying to come up with an outpatient regimen because GOG 172 required 24 hours of paclitaxel in order to avoid the neuropathy associated with paclitaxel and cisplatin together. We chose to give the 3 hours of paclitaxel on day one and then come back with cisplatin on day two with what we think so far has been an acceptable level of neurotoxicity. And so that was the second advance. We elected to continue with the intraperitoneal Taxol on day eight as an important part of the GOG 172 regimen. And the reason was we know that paclitaxel stays in the peritoneal cavity a long time. And we thought the sustained exposure to paclitaxel in the abdominal cavity was likely to be an important component in the success of GOG 172, and we wanted to retain that. So we did paclitaxel 135 per meter squared as a 3-hour infusion on day one. We did 75 milligrams per meter squared of cisplatin on day two, intraperitoneally, in 2 liters of fluid. And then on day 8, a week after the first dose of paclitaxel, we gave 60 milligrams per meter squared of paclitaxel as an IP, again in 2 liters. And that was the core regimen that we were building on. Now, beginning in cycle 2, we began to add the bevacizumab in. And so in cycle 2, people get bevacizumab on the same day that they get their IV paclitaxel at 15 milligrams per meter squared, which is the standard Q3 weekly dose of bevacizumab. And so we give paclitaxel and bev on day 1, we give cisplatin on day 2, and we give IP paclitaxel on day 8. And we do that sequentially for 5 of the 6 treatments, avoiding the first treatment because of the surgical issues. Then we have, because this is a safety issue, and we're trying to prove safety, we felt that it was important for us to also continue the Bev for up to a year afterward, because we wanted to be able to tell the GOG that they could use this arm and extend the bevacizumab all the way out to a full year after surgery without having adverse consequences.
It's similar strategy again in other tumors. That's what they did. I guess, you know, we're not going to know which part of it would be essential.
Well, and that's a question for a phase 3 trial.
Right.
And in a sense, by doing it this way, we get all of the safety data out of the way, because nobody goes on to more Bev unless they've already successfully received 5 cycles of Bev during their chemotherapy. And so you've got that safety endpoint, and then you've got a secondary safety endpoint of the extended Bev afterward. And we'll know the outcomes of both of those safety endpoints when we go back to the GOG and say, this is, we think, a tolerable regimen, and therefore it's a candidate for testing in a phase 3 randomized trial.
So can you talk about what you presented at ASCO?
What we've presented so far is that we've found that our goal is to accrue roughly 40 patients. And we felt that that would give us a really good estimate of the rate of toxicity for this triplet. And so what we've found so far is that patients can go through the regimen, that we don't have a large dropout rate, that the bevacizumab toxicities have been modest in addition to the platinum and paclitaxel. And the platinum and paclitaxel in this modified regimen, which allows us to do the whole thing as an outpatient, has been acceptable. We haven't had unacceptable rates of neuropathy. We've not had a lot of recurrent hospitalizations. And so thus far, based on what we presented at ASCO, we feel like we're on the road to identifying a tolerable regimen. Now, additional accrual is ongoing, and the safety analysis is also ongoing. But so far, our feeling has been that we have been able to do this in a safe and tolerable mechanism. We don't have any outcome data. So all we will be able to get out of the outcome data is the rate of progression for patients within the first year, which is really not going to be very robust because of the small number of patients.
So if you continue to see this type of safety profile, looking at your accrual, if you had to guess, when do you think maybe you could see a phase 3 trial launched, and when do you think we'd get the results from that study?
Okay, well, I think that the launching of the phase 3 goes hand in hand with the completion of GOG 218. And the GOG 218 estimates are anywhere between 18 to 24 months. And that gives us the better part of 2 years to finish our accrual in our pilot study. I don't think it'll take us that long. I expect that we'll be finished with accrual probably in the first quarter of 2009, but it's not certain yet.
So I guess the last thing I'd like to chat with you about is a little bit of just kind of clinical management. Again, the kinds of questions that docs in practice might ask you. And of course, we're looking forward to these newer research approaches, newer agents, et cetera, but still there are a lot of practical issues that they have to face. And what I'd like to get your take on is sort of your algorithm for managing patients with progressive disease as you go through second, third, fourth line therapy, how you integrate clinical trials, and how you make decisions about which type of systemic therapy you're going to use off study.
Mm-hmm. Well, being at Memorial Sloan Kettering, we try to have a single clinical trial available to patients in many of these steps going forward. So in our upfront program, we have two groups of patients. We have our optimally debulked patients and we have our suboptimal patients. Our optimally debulked patients are entered in the Connor trial that we've been talking about. Our suboptimally debulked patients would be offered the randomized trial 218, where two-thirds of the patients are receiving bevacizumab and the other third are not. And the patients who don't go on clinical trials are mostly not going on clinical trials because they're not suitable for bevacizumab. And those patients are getting carboplatin and Taxol off trial according to GOG 158, you know, what Bob Ozels did. The only exception being Bob still feels very strongly about an AUC of 7.5 as a starting point, and we feel like a starting point of AUC 6 is probably appropriate. But other than that, we tend to follow that regimen for our off-protocol patients. If someone had an optimally debulked ovarian cancer but couldn't receive Bev, we would give them the same Connor IP program but not add the bevacizumab. And so that would be our off-study intraperitoneal route if they were suitable for intraperitoneal treatment.
Now, how about therapy on progression?
So most of these patients will achieve at least a partial, if not a complete, remission. I think the patients who do not achieve remission but progress while they're receiving chemotherapy represent a really adverse group. And that's a group where there are no really great therapies. Those are patients for whom we would say off therapy Doxil is the right choice, understanding that these patients have a terrible outlook, and some of them, particularly the frail elderly, may be better served by not having chemotherapy at all. But it takes a good discussion with the patient in terms of their values and their desires. That would be a place where a really exciting new drug in phase two or even phase one might come to the fore before Doxil, because we know that Doxil and topotecan are going to give very low response rates in this group of patients. So this is a group of patients that would not be harmed by putting them on almost any investigational agent. In the patients that recur, we use the platinum sensitivity mark that Maury Markman has put forward, where certainly patients whose disease recurs within 6 months are most likely to receive either an investigational agent or Doxil. And the investigational agents in that setting, we always try to have a new drug in phase two for patients who represent the platinum-resistant group of patients, and the alternative would be a Doxil treatment.
When you talk about Doxil, how do you compare the potential risks and benefits of that versus other agents, for example, gemcitabine?
There's a recent publication, as you probably know, in JCO suggesting that the Doxil is similar to, certainly not inferior to, gemcitabine. I think that the one area that is important for a practicing physician to remember about Doxil is that Doxil has a slow onset of action. And in a patient who is having rapidly progressive disease, you may not have time to wait for Doxil to really begin to work. And in that setting, a topoisomerase inhibitor or gemcitabine is probably a better choice, because you can't really make an assessment about Doxil function and its effectiveness for a cancer patient in less than 3 months. And in a rapidly progressive circumstance, that may be a really long time. Otherwise, the Doxil has many advantages because it's administered once every 4 weeks, and we don't try to administer it once every 3 weeks. We don't start at the label 50 per meter squared. We've pretty much gone, as I think most practicing physicians have, to a 40 milligrams per meter squared starting dose, which we think is more tolerable. And at that dose, many patients can go from cycle to cycle without dose reduction or dose delay. And so we spend a little bit of time with our patients making sure that they understand the importance of moisturizing their hands and their feet to protect their skin from the toxicities that are associated with Doxil. But with attention to those kinds of details, keeping their hands out of harsh cleaning liquids, rubber gloves, those kinds of issues, we can generally get patients quite deeply into the Doxil. One of the questions that is, to my mind, not well understood, is exactly how much Doxil is enough and whether or not there is a logical endpoint to Doxil. The conservative approach is you begin to do echocardiograms, you know, as you go beyond two or three cycles of Doxil, and that when you get up to a maximum total doxorubicin dose in the 400 to 450 range, you have to really think carefully about what the benefit is for your patient, because there are those who say they've never really seen a true case of liposomal doxorubicin cardiotoxicity. I have certainly seen some of those patients had been previously exposed to doxorubicin as part of a treatment for breast cancer, for example. And I think one has to be circumspect about that and really make a careful risk-benefit analysis when you get up over 400 milligrams per meter squared of Doxil.
What is your sort of algorithm continuing past Doxil?
Once Doxil is been shown to be ineffective, then my two choices are gemcitabine, which I find to be generally pretty well tolerated, and I like gemcitabine. The use of topoisomerase inhibitors, I like topotecan. It's robust in terms of not having a lot of cumulative toxicity, but it is certainly myelosuppressive. And I am skeptical about the weekly topotecan data. I think that the size of those studies is such that one cannot be confident in saying that weekly topotecan is equivalent to the daily times five. And so in the absence of a compelling reason to do the weekly, I recommend my patients take the daily times five because I think it gives them the most likely opportunity for benefit.
As you suggested with the Doxil, you know, we're hoping you're going to see patients have a response that'll keep them on therapy for a while, but then the safety and toxicity issues come into play. Can you keep them on it? What's your experience in that regard with GEM?
With gemcitabine, I've generally found that to be quite well tolerated if you have the right dose. There, of course, are the allergic reactions, the skin reactions, the pulmonary reactions that you see with gemcitabine, and one has to be on the alert for those kinds of interactions. But in general, there are patients who can tolerate extended periods of 2 weeks on, 1 week off with gemcitabine without cumulative toxicity as well.
So the last thing I'm actually going to ask you, if I could, is there's a oncologist at the NCI named Herb Kotz. After the first program, he said, well, you know, that was pretty good, but there's a whole bunch of things you didn't talk about. So I threw a bunch of these out at Deborah Armstrong, and I just want to throw one more that he sent me that I thought was interesting, and it was actually a case that he wanted a response to. So here's the case. 48-year-old woman who goes to surgery for an adnexal mass by a gynecologic oncologist. Stage 1C or 2 endometrioid ovarian cancer was diagnosed in the right ovary and adherent to the right pelvic wall. The pelvic wall showed only benign adhesions. There was evidence of minimal endometriosis in the pelvis. A complete staging procedure revealed no other tumor. Washings were negative, but the patient was stage 1C by virtue of exophytic disease of the ovary. Since the patient didn't have insurance, she did not receive adjuvant chemotherapy that was recommended. And at this time, the physical exam is completely negative. There was no blood work or scans available, but she comes to the NIH for an exam and asking for advice. So here are his questions. First of all, should she receive treatment now 15 months after initial surgery?
All right, Herb, this one's for you. I would say that someone who is 15 months out from her primary surgery would probably not be a candidate for the initiation of chemotherapy at this time. I think that the early stage disease trials that have been done have been controversial. Certainly, the ICON data suggest, and the ERTC data that were analyzed together in the JNCI, I think about 2004, but time passes. But when they were analyzed together, ICON 1 and the ERTC data suggested that most of the benefit of chemotherapy probably went to patients who were poorly staged. And if she were truly a stage 1C patient and felt like she had had a very good surgery, I think one could defend not giving her chemotherapy even at the time of surgery. And that would not be the standard of care in the United States, and I certainly would not recommend that. Having said that, I think the data suggests that her additional benefit from chemotherapy would be modest, and 15 months later would be reduced further, and so I would say no chemotherapy.
So if you were pressed a given number, what would you say would be the original risk for recurrence, and what would the risk of recurrence be right now at 15 months, you think?
I think her risk of recurrence for an endometrioid cancer, 1C, based on it, exophytic but not without washings and with a abdominal sidewall adherence, probably is in the neighborhood of 15 or 20%. With chemotherapy, you'd probably reduce that by a third or a half and get her up in the 10% rate of recurrence. Many of the recurrences for low-stage disease occur in the first 12 to 18 months. And so she has essentially evaded the early relapse that might be occurring. And so probably if you took a group of women who didn't receive chemotherapy and said what percentage of them that are going to recur in the first 18 months, you'd probably be somewhere in the neighborhood of half. So I think that she's probably evaded half of her risk. And so I would estimate that her likelihood of relapse at this point might be 7 to 10%.
So a related question from Dr. Kotz, would this patient be managed differently by Europeans than in the United States?
Well, as I suggested, I think in certain parts of Europe, and I think that it's important to recognize that the UK is somewhat different than other parts of continental Europe, particularly Western Europe, she might be offered the opportunity for careful observation as opposed to immediate intervention with chemotherapy. The difficulty is that the surgical quality in the UK is much more variable. There are certainly some wonderful surgeons in the UK, but there are also many patients in the UK that have their surgery from less qualified surgeons. And so the real risk there is that if she had a less than perfect operation in the UK, she might really be considered to be at a higher risk for having a higher stage disease and therefore be more likely to benefit from chemotherapy.
Another related question, if she did receive treatment, what treatment, how many cycles?
There are no easy answers to low stage ovarian cancer management. In the United States, the standard of care is carboplatin plus paclitaxel. The Europeans have chosen carbo as a single agent as being equivalent. I would say that the data support three cycles. I think no one in the United States would be comfortable with less than three cycles. The 3 versus 6 study that was done by the gynecologic oncology group is a little slippery. And the reason is that when you talk about low-stage disease, you have a low event rate. That is, 70% of the patients will be cured from surgery alone and will never be able to contribute to the power of the study. So all of the outcome really depends on what happens to that last 30%, and powering a study to answer a real question in that context is very hard. What you saw in the 3 versus 6 study that was done by the gynecologic oncology group was there was a trend that did not meet statistical significance towards superiority for 6 cycles of therapy.
Final question from Dr. Kotz. If she is going to have no treatment, how should she be followed? The only CA-125 she had was 21, which was pre-op.
Yeah. For patients of mine who have never had a CA-125 in the abnormal range, I recommend CT scans on a 3-monthly basis for 3 years. I would still follow her CA-125 because that might be misleading, but I would certainly not count on the CA-125. Now, if the CA-125 at the time of diagnosis had been 210 rather than 21, it is my feeling that she could be followed by physical exam and CA-125 alone and only have CTs at the time that she either had symptoms or rising CA-125. But with all of the CA-125s in her record being within the normal range, I think one has to look at CT scan as the gold standard. I would follow her quarterly for 3 years from her original diagnosis, 2 or 3 times a year till year 5, and then probably annually thereafter.